From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The president does believe that law-abiding citizens have the right to bear arms. And what we must do is crack down on existing laws and enforce the laws we have so that people who commit crimes, especially crimes with guns, will be fully prosecuted and serve time.
The president's spokesperson says Bush will not support ballistic fingerprinting, a way to trace a bullet to its gun. In this age of sniper politics, the administration says the answer is the militarization of police. Then, it's the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll speak with Estela Bravo about her new film, Fidel.
It's David is remembered. He fought Goliath. The Cubans.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and British warplanes bombed a communication center southeast of Baghdad on Iraq's election day Tuesday. Pentagon officials said the facility was used to link its radars to command centers for surface-to-air missiles. Meanwhile, negotiations continue over a UN Security Council resolution. Russia said Tuesday a U.S. draft UN resolution on Iraq that would call for the automatic use of force is unacceptable. French President Jacques Chirac said in an interview published today he knew of no relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda and warned a war on Baghdad could provoke terrorists to stage new attacks. And China continues to warn against calls for military action and wants a political solution to the crisis. Meanwhile, Qatar on Tuesday says it opposes any U.S.-led war against Iraq, but the Gulf nation has yet to decide if it will grant Washington's request to use its bases for an attack. By December, a $1.4 billion U.S. grade of airbase in Qatar is due for competition with a state-of-the-art command and control room. In addition, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, which is not on the UN Security Council, warned a U.S.-led use of preemptive military power on Iraq could lead to escalating terrorism, perhaps even nuclear terrorism. A former member of the Indonesian Air Force has confessed to investigators he assembled the bomb that destroyed the heart of Bali's nightclub district Saturday, killing at least 181 people. The suspect, who learned to make explosives while serving in the Air Force, did not disclose who ordered him to make the bomb. Police said material found at the scene of the bombing was similar to explosives used in August 2000 to bomb the Jakarta residence of the Philippine ambassador to Indonesia and attack the Philippine intelligence officials have blamed on radical Islamic network known as Jamaah Islamiyah. Police said investigators were also intensively interrogating two other men in connection with the bombing. An Indonesian security source said his government learned a week before the bombing that Muslim extremists were planning to carry out an attack. Security was heightened at 60 locations around the country, but not in Bali, because the authorities did not suspect that militants would strike that resort island. Also on Tuesday, the Indonesian government announced plans to enact emergency anti-terrorism legislation. Members of the security forces, going back to the head of military intelligence, have long been linked to Islamic militant groups in Indonesia. Miami-Dade County in Florida has voted to hire the Center for Democracy to monitor the November elections. The county government narrowly voted last night to spend $92,000 to hire experts from the Washington-based organization, which has previously sent monitors to elections in El Salvador, Panama, Honduras, Nicaragua, Poland, and Russia, among other countries. The county was the center of major election day problems during both last month's primary and the stolen election of 2000. In Illinois, the cases of 142 death row prisoners will be reviewed, with the possibility that the state's governor, George Ryan, will commute all their sentences to life in prison. The unprecedented 9 days of hearings at the Prisoner Review Board will effectively put the death penalty itself on trial. Governor Ryan, who leaves office in January, was the first to declare a moratorium on executions 3 years ago after three murder convictions were overturned with examinations of DNA evidence. An anonymous caller to a San Jose television station took credit for a pre-dawn fire at a military recruiting office Monday, cryptically referring to the blaze as a preemptive strike. Fire crews found two government-owned parked vehicles in the rear of the office area engulfed in flames. They also discovered broken glass and the words "preemptive strike" written on the front walls in red paint, an apparent reference to the possibility the United States could launch a military attack on Iraq. And in the latest development in the Central Park jogger case, the New York Times is reporting three of the five Harlem teenagers convicted in the 1989 rape of the jogger in Central Park insisted that jury verdicts, history books, and their own videotape statements had it entirely wrong. They actually had nothing to do with the attack. Their persistence in claiming innocence instead of conveying remorse for the assault cost them their best chance to reduce their prison terms. This according to parole records made public yesterday. Again, at this point, a rapist murderer named Matthias Reis has claimed responsibility for the attack on the jogger, and he said he did it alone. DNA evidence corroborates that he did attack the jogger in Central Park. The five young men who were convicted at the time have served more than up to 13 years in prison. The last of the men getting out of prison just about a month ago.
Ducky would close his eyes and cry bittersweetly and wonder who possibly could be to blame.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, millions took to the polls yesterday to express their support for Saddam Hussein, according to government officials. Saddam received 100% of support from over 11 million registered voters who cast ballots. There were no candidates on the ballot, no party ticket to choose from. There wasn't even a question. People were simply asked to mark one of two boxes, yes or no. The last time a referendum was held on the Iraqi leader was in 1995, when he received more than 99.9% yes votes. Iraq said the overwhelming support sent a message to the Bush administration: Iraqis will not accept an American occupation. Well, yesterday, Democracy Now! Correspondent, together with filmmaker Jackie Suin, one of a handful of journalists who was granted a rare tour of Tikrit, the birthplace of Saddam Hussein. They filed this report after their visit. This is the fifth in a series of our Iraq Journal series.
نعم يا نوثالة تنعم الراع الحامي يا صدام.
It's not often that foreign journalists have been allowed on these streets. This is Tikrit, the birthplace of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. It's like a small country within Iraq, heavily fortified and closed off. But the history of this city cuts much deeper than the current Iraqi leader. It's also the birthplace of the Muslim warrior Saladin, who crushed the Crusaders and liberated Jerusalem in 1187. More than 800 years later, Tikrit is Saddam country. At the gates to the city, a large mural depicts an epic Saddam Hussein riding on horseback toward Jerusalem. Missiles and warplanes soar through the sky above him. But just moments after we got off our bus to film the city gates, a car sped up and plainclothes security forces jumped out and began ordering journalists to turn off their cameras. But when a truckload of Iraqi army pulled up and began dancing and chanting in the streets, the plainclothes security officers joined them. In the city center, the scene was the same everywhere we went.
This is the heartland of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's support, his birthplace Tikrit, and the people have taken to the streets to send a message to George W. Bush that they're behind Saddam Hussein and that they're ready for a U.S. invasion.
Technically, this referendum was supposed to be a secret ballot, but people seemed very eager to show off which box they had checked. Almost everyone we spoke with said the exact same thing.
I select the leader Saddam Hussein. I report yes for leader Saddam Hussein. We send a message for Bush. We say for him we select the leader Saddam Hussein. And we reject America. This is a message for America. We select Saddam Hussein forever. We all fight the America. We all are ready to protect this country against the American intrusion.
After spending a few hours in Tikrit, one's ears begin to ring from the same chants repeated over and over. But when the people of this city chant that they will give their blood for Saddam, they mean what they say. Many people slice their thumbs with knives before smearing their blood over the box marked yes. The message in Tikrit was all about saying no to George W. Bush, and it appears that Washington responded. At 2:15 local time in the middle of the poll, U.S. warplanes bombed the city of Kut, 100 miles southeast of Baghdad. Another reminder of where things appear to be heading. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Tikrit, the birthplace of Saddam Hussein.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! For more of Jeremy and Jackie's reports, you can go to democracynow.org and to iraqjournal.org. Again, the only independent media organization in this country nationally broadcasting reports from the ground in Baghdad, Iraq. We're going to turn now to the sniper politics of Washington, D.C. The search for the serial sniper has renewed calls for a national ballistic fingerprint system that supporters say could quickly link the bullets found at shooting scenes to a suspect. Bullets and shell casings fired from a handgun contain unique markings like fingerprints, which can be used to link specific handguns with gun crimes. Law enforcement can use these markings to determine if a specific bullet or shell casing was fired from a specific firearm. Ballistics or gun fingerprinting proposals require that handguns be test-fired before they're sold and that its unique fingerprints be entered into a computer database that will be accessible to law enforcement. New York Senator Charles Schumer has announced he will introduce federal legislation to create such a registry, but that registry is coming under intense criticism from the National Rifle Association and George Bush. A spokesperson for the NRA, which has said little publicly in reaction to the sniper shootings, said, "We feel any effort to push a political agenda on the backs of these shootings is crass and reprehensible." Yesterday, Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, said the president opposes the push for firearms fingerprinting because he's not convinced of the technology's accuracy and is concerned about gun owners' privacy.
Behavior and people who use guns to commit murder, there's no amount of laws that's going to stop these people from committing these depraved crimes. The issue is their morality. The issue is their values. And they have broken the law. They will break the law. New laws don't stop people like this. What stops people like this is tough enforcement of the laws.
I wonder if you could clarify something for me. Under the U.S. Patriot Act, there are individual rights that are in question because the provisions in there, at times with respect to individual privacy, are superseded by protecting Americans. That seems to be the administration's argument for sometimes protecting us against terrorism at the expense of privacy or individual rights. So would you clarify for me why, if there are spent shell casings, such as in the case that was found in one of the sites here, why the administration would be opposed to being able to trace that back to a gun purchaser? Are you concerned about the privacy rights of an individual gun owner at the expense of the safety of Americans?
Well, again, it gets back to the exact point I was making before, and that is there are law-abiding Americans and then there are criminals. And just as if you were to fingerprint every single law-abiding American, it might give you a helpful clue to determine who engaged in a robbery or in a theft. Do you want to apply that across the board for every instance? And the president does believe that law-abiding citizens have the right to bear arms. And what we must do is crack down on existing laws and enforce the laws we have so that people who commit crimes, especially crimes with guns, will be fully prosecuted and serve time.
And that was Bush spokesperson Ari Fleischer. As we turn now to Eric Horowitz, who is policy director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. You are listening to Democracy Now! Welcome, Eric Horowitz.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you talk about this, what I have not seen mentioned at all watching television, this issue of connecting a bullet to a gun and then being able to trace the owner?
Yeah, it's actually bullets and shell casings, and it works for any firearm. And the basic idea is that the way guns operate, a firing pin makes an impression on the shell casing, and that's what starts the combustion process that ends up driving the bullet out the barrel of the gun. And as a result of that combustion process, the bullet is propelled very quickly down the barrel, and it scrapes along the inside of the barrel, and the barrel leaves markings on the bullet, and the shell casing is pressed very hard against the inside of the firing chamber, and the characteristics of the surfaces inside the firing chamber leave marks on the shell casing. And with semi-automatic firearms, handguns or long guns, if the gun is fired a second time or another round is chambered, the empty shell casing is ejected. So the evidence left behind at crime scenes often includes bullets that are in the wall or in the person who was shot or found on the ground, and shell casings that are left behind. And that's, both of those have been recovered in the sniper shootings. And they can be used both to connect serial crimes with each other and to connect a given crime with a specific firearm. So that's the basic idea of using that evidence that's left behind at a crime scene to identify specific guns by the unique markings that are left on that evidence.
Can you talk about the opposition to being able to trace these bullets? To say the least, in the Washington area, we're talking about a massive crisis right now.
Yeah, there just isn't any credible opposition to using this law enforcement technique. It's a proven technique that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms says they've used thousands of times to solve crimes and to connect crimes with other crimes. And it creates leads where none exist. And the concerns about privacy just demonstrate a misunderstanding of how the technology works, that ballistic fingerprinting links evidence from a crime scene to a gun. And if we had nothing more than existing law, what that would allow would allow an investigation of what happened to that gun, which we can currently do with records currently maintained under federal law, and get to the first legal purchaser of that gun. So you can get from the shell casing recovered at a crime scene, you can get to a person who had their hands on the gun that produced that that crime scene evidence. That's a lead, and it's an important lead to pursue. And to tell law enforcement that they shouldn't be allowed to pursue it is just it's a horrible blow to law enforcement to take that out of their toolkit.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking with Eric Horowitz, who is policy director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. And after him, we will be joined by an expert on the militarization of police. The administration's answer is not ballistic fingerprinting, but bringing in the military. Stay with us.
Wrong, but later I found out our country's found it on. Burn down the rainbow, yellow, red, into black. Lie like juveniles, because we don't want to give it back. Who takes opportunity. I'll generate degrading jobs and say they have no worth. The punks get upset, I'll stick them in jail.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about something that has gotten almost no attention in the press, the emphasis in the sniper shootings and the trail of fear with police tracking new leads after the sniper's ninth killing, is that they just have very little evidence except for witness reports of seeing perhaps a white or cream-colored van after a victim goes down. What has not been raised is this possibility of somehow linking the bullet that is left in the victim that the police certainly have with the gun that the sniper is shooting, the high-velocity rifle. Our guest is Eric Gorowitz, Policy Director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. What about the media coverage? Because if the media raised this at all, it seems there would be an outcry.
Well, the media actually are beginning to pick it up. I've done lots of press in the last couple of days, which is the best indicator I have. The fact that it was raised, and maybe it was you who raised it at the White House press briefing, I think is an important indicator that it's catching on, the discussion is catching on. Whether that means that this administration is able to avoid doing the bidding of the gun lobby remains to be seen. Ari Fleischer's comments that you played earlier make clear that the Bush administration is more concerned about serving the needs of the gun lobby than it is about protecting the public in this instance. And my hope is that with increasing visibility as more media outlets pick up this story, the pressure will increase on them not to do that. It's been interesting how quiet the NRA has been on its own, but now it seems they don't need to talk about it because they have the president speaking for them.
We're talking to Eric Gorowitz of the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. I would like to bring in our next guest as well. What the Bush administration is doing is talking about bringing in the military. Christopher Pyle is now with us, who has written extensively about the militarization of police. Can you talk about this as a response to what we're seeing in Washington now?
Which?
Christopher Pyle, can you talk about the militarization of police?
Well, it's not clear just how far they've gone, but there's a new Army command, the Northern Command, which went into existence on October 1st. And this command is responsible for patrolling the skies, patrolling the seas out to 500 miles, and could very well become the basis of a military surveillance operation within the United States. It's too early to tell. The lower level people may get enthusiastic about that. There's some resistance at the Pentagon level. There seems to be some enthusiasm for militarization of this form of law enforcement at the White House level. There are no objections, probably, or no strong objections at the Justice Department, but that remains to be seen. It's all quite in a state of flux. But this typically happens when the nation is in crisis, like World War I, World War II, or during the civil rights and anti-war movements in the 1960s. Then the military got off the reservation, were drawn into civilian surveillance, were sharing their information with police departments, and were violating the Posse Comitatus Act and the First Amendment.
Explain what the Posse Comitatus Act is.
That's a law passed in 1878. That said, the military was not to be involved, or the Army was not to be involved in civilian law enforcement.
I'm looking at an AP report that says Army planes with high-tech surveillance equipment preparing Wednesday to take to the skies around the nation's capital to help track a sniper who's eluded law enforcement officials for 2 weeks. The planes are being flown to the region, expected to join the hunt within days. Authorities called in the military Tuesday to help solve the baffling case that has left 9 people dead, terrorized the capital area, people afraid to go out of their homes. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld on Tuesday evening agreed to an FBI request for the help approving use of the Army's Airborne Reconnaissance Low Plane, which has surveillance capabilities beyond those of local police forces. The plan calls for military pilots to fly reconnaissance flights accompanied by federal agents who would relay any collected information to authorities on the ground.
That's permitted by exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act that were passed in the 1980s. Those were passed to involve the military in the drug war, and military planes have been used to spot planes in the Caribbean bringing in drugs. Navy ships have been used as platforms on which the Coast Guard can interdict sailboats carrying drugs. And they've used the military brigs on Navy ships to hold the drug smugglers. This is a kind of loan of equipment, loan of technical expertise in a so-called passive role, and the courts have upheld that. There, of course, you can see the problems with that as the passive moves to active and as the practice becomes more routine rather than exceptional. But there are exceptions, and this may very well be one of them, where the military has equipment nobody else has. It is loaned for that particular purpose and is not part of the routine militarization of law enforcement. The same would be true with using Army field hospitals in a disaster or using the military to fight an unusual forest fire that the civilians can't handle.
But what about this idea that there are possible ways to trace a bullet to a gun, to possibly a gun owner or a previous owner, that there are ways to actually accurately track down, possibly, who is
the
sniper?
At least to the first owner, yes, that makes a lot of sense. This is not perfect by any means, but it's a very sensible law enforcement tool. Never understood the opposition to it. There's no privacy interest particularly in that.
Well, it's interesting that the administration, Ari Fleischer, specifically referred to the privacy of innocent civilians being invaded when you track a bullet to a gun.
A bullet out of a human body to a gun.
Not a bullet
out of a deer or a moose or an antelope.
And yet they're not talking about privacy issues when they talk about these high-tech surveillance planes that have surveillance capabilities, certainly beyond local police forces. Features of the four-engine plane provides high-resolution imagery and night vision. Now, these, I'm sure, are things in a time of crisis. People are willing to give up something because they are terrified. But if there are ways that things could be scientifically tracked, they're not talking about privacy in the area of bringing in the military.
But that kind of equipment could be purchased by civilian agencies. The Supreme Court has begun to show a bit of concern about this with surveillance of houses with heat-seeking cameras and held that that couldn't be done without a probable cause warrant. It's a rare act when the Supreme Court now defends privacy, but it did in that particular case, and might very well if the civilians start adopting this equipment. But this equipment in this case would be used for one mission only, a very special mission where a multi-state region is being terrorized by a very specific criminal with a specific modus operandi. And so I don't see that as a serious problem. The problem becomes when it becomes routinized, and when the military starts keeping data banks and files and sharing them with the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, and others, then you have the apparatus of a police state. And occasional assistance doesn't raise serious problems to me.
Christopher Pyle teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. He's author of Military Preemptive Strike. Of a book looking at the military and the militarization of police. Eric Gorovitz, were you just trying to say something?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I agree with you that the privacy issue raised by Mr. Fleischer is just a straw man. I mean, there isn't any privacy impact of ballistic fingerprinting, and it just highlights how out of step the gun lobby's position is, and hence the president's position, with the views not just of the general public or advocates like me, but the views of most gun owners who think that law enforcement should have these tools at their disposal.
Christopher Pyle, you're saying?
I'm a gun owner, and I'm delighted to have a gun license, and I'm delighted if I would be delighted if ammunition were tagged. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Is the National Rifle Association operating the way they promised to right before the president was selected or elected, however you view it, when they said put out a fundraising letter saying that if Bush is elected, we'll be operating right out of the Oval Office?
Absolutely. In this instance, the White House spokesperson is functioning as the gun lobby spokesperson. They have not publicly taken a position on ballistic fingerprinting other than to say, make that comment that you quoted earlier about attributing ill motives to the timing of talking about ballistic fingerprinting. Of course, they weren't saying that when they went to Flint 2 days after a six-year-old shot another six-year-old to hold a gun rights rally, or when they went to Denver 10 days after Columbine to hold their annual conference. That wasn't crass, but in the midst of a shooting in which law enforcement has the evidence but not the tool to use the evidence to solve the shooting, they're saying that we're being crass. That's their only comment on the issue, and the president is putting forth their agenda for them.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, sounds like operating out of the Oval Office, which is what they claimed would happen.
So how does it work right now in terms of legislation, in terms of this ballistic fingerprinting? You've got Schumer, the Democratic senator from New York, who's introduced the legislation. Where does it go now? How can people weigh into the process?
Well, there are two bills, and I'm sort of scrambling to get my hands on the numbers. There are two bills. The bill in the Senate, which was introduced just the other day by Mr. Schumer, Mr. Cole, Ms. Feinstein, and Mr. Reid, is Senate Bill 3096. There's also a House bill, which was actually introduced quite some time ago by Mr. Andrews of New Jersey. It was introduced in 2001, and that's H.R. 408. Those bills, I think, are both likely to get renewed attention, and they're currently, the House bill is sitting in the judiciary, in a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, and the Senate bill, of course, was just introduced, but they will be coming up, and I think under increasing scrutiny, they will be coming up, and it's a good opportunity for people who believe in ballistic fingerprinting to contact their legislators and ask them to support those bills. And people can get more information from the Educational Fund website at efsgv.org.
Christopher Pyle, you've written Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics. I'm looking at some photographs from the memory hole from the D.C. Indie Media site, which shows people from the military, in combat gear, armed with cameras and video cameras, military filming protesters at D.C. demonstrations, the anti-World Bank IMF demonstrations, September 27th to September 29th. This is before the sniper struck. Your response to that?
I see no problem with that at all. So far as I can tell, that's used for command and control of military forces in a legitimate mission, which is to keep the peace on the streets. The problem would arise if the film from those cameras was then archived and protesters were identified and put in watch lists of various sorts. This is what the Army did in the 1960s. I had the pleasure of disclosing the Army's domestic spying operations in the 1960s. I had been an officer in Army intelligence. And the Army had data banks on some 6 million people, and was covering every demonstration of 20 people or more, and was doing so not in uniform like these soldiers, but in civilian clothes. And so they were essentially running the apparatus of a police state, not with the motivations of creating a police state, but with a kind of indifference to the civil liberties implications of creating that kind of a record system on lawful, First Amendment-protected civilian political activity. That's the great danger, and we're now at one of those moments in history where command and control surveillance for locating troops in a situation can gradually metastasize into domestic spying on civilians by the military. And that's when you get the militarization of law enforcement functions, and that's very dangerous.
Christopher Pyle, teaching constitutional law at Mount Holyoke College. As we talk about the militarization of police, Eric Horowitz, if people are concerned right now, the overall, because the sniper coverage is getting so much attention, people are so terrorized. While you say you may be getting some press interviews, in watching the TV coverage that is almost wall-to-wall now, I have rarely seen on television, whether or not there are some articles on this, these issues being raised about the ballistic fingerprinting. Has, for example, the president himself been asked about this in the last day? He was questioned by reporters as he was walking somewhere.
I'm not aware of anything beyond that, and you make a very good point.
And the idea that the NRA is saying to introduce this issue at a time like this is crude politics, is simply crass.
Well, I mean, I think this is when issues like this get introduced, this unfolding story that's been on the news for 2 weeks now is only the best example, the most current example of the utility of this tool, the tool of ballistic fingerprinting. As I said, there's been a bill in Congress for almost 2 years. It's not a new issue. It's getting new visibility because people are all of a sudden understanding that that it's a real issue. And, you know, the law enforcement's been using ballistic fingerprinting, having access only to evidence that is recovered at crime scenes, and therefore being able just to link cases. And also, when they recover a gun, they can test fire it and link crime scene evidence to that gun. But law enforcement's been doing that for years, and it works extremely well. What they don't have is the ability to make the connection directly from crime scene evidence to a specific gun that they have not come into contact before. And that's the importance of these new proposals. And I think not only is it not crass to be talking about these issues now, as we have been talking about them for years, I think it's appropriate to do everything we can to give law enforcement the tools that they need to solve this crime and hundreds of others that go unsolved without this tool.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Eric Horowitz joining us from the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. Christopher Pyle joining us from Mount Holyoke College, author of Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll turn to this 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll speak with filmmaker Estela Bravo. Her new film, Fidel, is opening in New York this weekend. Stay with us.
With his eyes to the sky, I know that I can't change, and I'll scream till my voice runs dry.
Hands.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm looking at Jane Franklin's book, Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. And it says on this day, in October 16th of 1963, of 1962, talking about what happened. President Kennedy and his closest advisors deliberate on what to do about Cuban sites for nuclear weapons that could be used against the United States. On October 16th, Attorney General Robert Kennedy discussed the idea of using the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo in some way that would justify an invasion. The quote is, "We should also think of whether there is some other way we can get involved in this through Guantanamo Bay, or whether there's some ship that, you know, sink the Maine again or something." Tapes of at least part of these discussions are made public at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston in 1983. The U.S. Was trying to topple Fidel Castro before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Today, we're joined by Estela Bravo, the acclaimed filmmaker who has made more than 30 films on Latin America, who spends her time between the United States and Latin America. Her latest film is called Fidel, and it's opening this weekend in New York at the Quad Cinema. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Be here.
Why don't we begin, though, with a clip of your film? And this is the events leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the CIA began dropping bombs.
The CIA began to plan the assassination of Fidel and Raul and Che, whatever leadership they could get, but especially Fidel.
This is former CIA agent Philip Agee.
And make the Bay of Pigs invasion more likely to be successful.
In 1961, John Kennedy inherited the invasion plans from Eisenhower. He allowed it to go ahead, but vetoed the use of U.S. combat forces. As preliminary acts leading to the invasion, saboteurs burned thousands of acres of sugarcane, and the La Cubre, a Belgian freighter carrying arms, was blown up at a Havana dock. A second bomb was timed to explode as volunteers reached the burning ship to help the victims. Over 100 people were killed and hundreds more wounded. Moreover, exiled Cuban pilots flying American planes painted with Cuban insignia bombed two airports, killing a number of civilians.
Just an excerpt from Fidel by Estela Bravo. This is leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Can you set the stage for us?
Well,
you do an excellent history in this film.
Yes, but this part of the film really was leading up to the Bay of Pigs invasion, you see. That was a year before the missile crisis, and that was a failure. And in 72 hours, all the invading forces were eliminated and captured, whatever. And the people who were captured were exchanged later for medicines and baby food. So the missile crisis happened a year later. In fact, right now.
But important for people to understand that, especially when we go back 40 years, that the Bay of Pigs was before the Cuban Missile Crisis. That the efforts to topple Fidel Castro, who had come to power in Cuba, had been going on intensively under the Kennedy administration.
Oh yes, and plans for assassination of Fidel Castro throughout these years. It's a miracle if Fidel Castro is alive today. There are over 300 assassination attempts that have been openly recognized by Congress, and it really is unusual. I've interviewed people who were involved in those assassination attempts.
And talk about what they said, as they themselves tried to assassinate Fidel Castro.
I interviewed a woman in Miami, and she had gotten a capsule to a friend in the Havana Libre Hotel, the former Havana Hilton Hotel, and she'd given it to a waiter. This was at the beginning of the revolution, and he had put it in the freezer of the hotel where he worked, and he knew that Fidel liked chocolate malteds or whatever, or chocolate ice cream or what, malteds especially. And Fidel did go into the hotel, and the waiter went to get his capsule, And what happened? It had opened up in the freezer, and he couldn't use it. So Fidel has escaped many times just by pure luck, and also because he doesn't repeat the same thing. He goes different places. He has good bodyguards, obviously, too.
And what connections, if any, did they have to the U.S. government?
Well, most of them were these people. The woman I interviewed was a member, was from the CIA. She spoke to the camera. She was very ill, and she was telling me about her involvement in many of these things against Cuba.
It's interesting because we had Ted Sorensen on last week, who is the special counsel to President Kennedy, who is decrying what Bush is doing now, talking about preemptive strike, and also condemning Ari Fleischer and the Bush administration for saying that Saddam Hussein should be assassinated, encouraging someone to take a gun and do away with Saddam Hussein. And yet that was happening 40 years ago over and over and over again in the Kennedy administration.
Right. In fact, today they're all still in Cuba meeting. There's a conference in Cuba on the missile crisis, and there are even people who participated in Kevin Costner's 13 Days who are there too. And Althaus Schlesinger is there, Sorensen is there, McNamara is there. I witnessed the meeting of McNamara with Fidel, and that was something, and the head of the CIA. I asked Schlesinger, what happened when you met Fidel? What was that like? Because you were involved in the Bay of Pigs and a lot of the things that were done against Cuba. So he looked at me and he says, you know, Fidel forgave me. It was a strange answer, but that's what he said.
You interview many luminaries about the significance of Fidel Castro. You spent a good deal of time with Fidel himself, is that right, in the filming?
Well, we began 10 years ago to do this film, and it was a British production. It was originally aired on Channel 4 in London, and then in Canada we did a remake of it and put it up to date. And yes, we've interviewed many interesting people, Ted Turner, people who don't share Fidel Castro's ideological views, but yet have a friendship with him and a respect for him.
I want to turn to this excerpt of the documentary where you talk about Fidel Castro in Africa. Let's turn to Estela Bravo's Fidel.
It's not just Castro the man. He carries with him a meaning, a signification, which is of tremendous importance to people like ourselves who are the marginalized of the world. And Africa, as a mother country to so many Cubans, needed to be addressed as part and parcel of the worldwide thing of African liberation.
Right from the beginning, Cuba's revolutionary ideals not only spread throughout Latin America, but also forged strong ties with national liberation leaders, such as Sekou Touré, Amilcar Cabral, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel, and Agostino Neto.
Cuando se produce la invasión de Angola por tropas regulares de África del Sur, no podíamos cruzarnos de brazos.
When regular South African troops invaded Angola, we couldn't stand by. When the MPLA called, we offered them help.
In 1975, as Angola moved towards independence from Portugal, the CIA, along with the apartheid government of South Africa, tried to bring down the new Angolan government. At the request of the Angolan president, Fidel sent 36,000 troops to keep the South African forces from attacking Luanda, the capital. For many Cubans, whose ancestors were African slaves, the fight in Angola was a way to repair a debt to history.
This is Fidel Castro in Angola, talking to soldiers. Where are you from, he says, and talking to his Cuban soldiers there.
In 14 years of war, over 300,000 Cubans, doctors, teachers, and engineers, as well as soldiers, played an important role in Angola. More than 2,000 lost their lives. In 1988, Fidel sent in more Cuban troops, for the decisive battle at Quito Cuanavale and directed operations from Cuba. The defeat of the South African army drove a large nail into the coffin of apartheid and helped advance the struggle of the South African people.
A defeat in those circumstances could have meant the end of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro says. All this happened after 75. All that material should be compiled, but we haven't even written the history of the Cuban Revolution, he says. This is Harry Belafonte.
In Africa, and in particular in Angola, the history of Africa would have never been what it is now. One of the greatest friends that Cuba has is Nelson Mandela, and his appreciation for what the Cuban people did, and Fidel Castro. But I think if you don't understand that history, then you'll never really understand the enormous success and the importance of the Cuban Revolution.
Well, my president. My president.
My brother.
President and my brother.
How are you?
My brother.
Please. Please. Very nice to see you.
Estoy tan contento de verlo.
Please sit down.
Tan contento. Por favor, tenga bien sentarse.
Please sit down.
Siéntese.
Now, one thing before we say anything.
Una cosa antes de hablar, nada.
Before we say anything.
Antes de hablar absolutamente de cualquier tema.
You must tell me when you are coming to South Africa.
Me tiene que decir cuándo viene para Sudáfrica.
Yo sé,
No.
And we have had a visitor from a wide variety of people.
Una gran cantidad de personas.
And our friend Cuba.
Y nuestro amigo Cuba.
Which helped us in training our people.
Que nos ayudó a entrenar a nuestra gente.
Gave us resources to get on with our struggle.
Que nos ayudaron tanto nuestra
trained
lucha.
Our people. As doctors and so on. You have not come to our country.
Cuba no ha venido a visitarnos. Usted no ha ido a visitarnos.
When are you coming?
¿Cuándo viene?
No he visitado a mi patria surafricana.
I haven't visited my South African homeland
yet. La quiero como una patria.
I want it. I love it as a homeland.
Y para el pueblo.
I love it as a homeland as I love you and the South African people.
When are you coming to South
Africa? Pero ¿cuándo viene a Sudáfrica?
Creo que va a tener que ser hoy mismo. Va a tener
I think it will have to be today. I will have to fly back with you.
No, you are very, very, very
soon. You are leaving at 10, so we are catching the plane together.
Soon afterwards, Fidel did go to South Africa and on his way stop off in Namibia, where he was greeted by Sam Nujoma, the nation's leader.
Welcome to the Republic of Namibia.
Bienvenido a la República de Namibia.
The country which you helped to reparate, to be reparated.
In South Africa, Mandela was waiting. Fidel was invited to address the South African Parliament.
Conviértase Sudáfrica en modelo de un mundo futuro más justo y más humano.
Let South Africa be a model of a more just and more humane future.
Si ustedes pueden, todos podemos.
If you can do it, we will all be able to do it.
Fidel Castro addressing the South African Parliament. And as we wrap up the program, Estela Bravo, you captured all of this and also yes. traveled with Fidel
yes.
Castro.
No, I was very fortunate because I was in South Africa the two times that Fidel, I was able to be a witness to the Fidel and his relationship with Nelson Mandela. And for me, that was very, very special. I also had an opportunity of being with Mandela before Fidel ever met Mandela. Fidel, and soon after he got out of prison, and he had said that he was very anxious to visit Cuba because he wanted to thank Fidel and the Cuban people for all the support that he got. It was quite unusual. For me, it was a learning process, too, because I didn't realize how important Cuba was in Africa, and in Angola, in Namibia, and especially Mandela. Mandela has a special relationship with Fidel, and these, I think, are the two men left alive of this last century who are different histories but are very united in many ways.
In fact, as you show the Africa segment on your documentary, many of the slaves, possibly the majority, that were brought to Cuba were from Angola.
Yes. I once interviewed one of the most important Cuban generals, a black man, who was one of the first people to go to Africa, to Angola. And he told me, he said, you know, I think if my ancestors could see me now, how proud they would be of me going back to Africa to help them. Yeah, so I always remember the black people who went to Angola, a lot of black soldiers from Cuba, too, had a lot of those same feelings.
I remember the dressing down that Nelson Mandela did of Ted Koppel when Koppel asked him about his relationship with Fidel Castro.
Yes. And also in Cuba, when Mandela was there, somebody from the Miami Herald asked him, aren't you worried about what the Miami Herald will say about your visit to Cuba? And so he got very, very angry, and he said, where were those Cubans in Miami when I was in prison? Did they ever speak out? We went to the United States for help, and we never got any help from the United States in those years. The first country that helped us was Cuba.
Well, Mandela got it wrong there. The U.S. was involved with identifying where he was and gave that information to the South Africa apartheid regime, and that's how he was first arrested and then held in prison for more than two decades. Well, Estela Bravo, thank you very much for being with us. Best of luck on the release of your documentary this weekend at the Quad Cinema in New York and then all over the country. I want to thank you for being with us, Estela Bravo, filmmaker acclaimed. Her latest film is called Fidel. That does it for Democracy Now! If you would like to go to our website, go to democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogueira, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!